fighting soldiers from the sky. Fearless men who jump and die. Men who mean just what they say. The brave men of the Green Beret. Silver wings upon their chest. These are men, America's best. 100 men will test today, but only 3 win the Green Beret. Trained to live off nature's land, trained in combat hand to hand. Men who fight by night and day, courage take from the Green Beret. Silver wings upon their chest. These are men, America's best. 100 men will test today, but only 3 win the Green Beret. Back at home, a young wife waits. Her Green Beret has met his fate. He has died for those oppressed, leaving her this last request. Put silver wings on my son's chest. Make him one of America's best. He'll be a man they'll test one day. Have him win the Green Beret.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Tim Spencer sitting in for John Moore on Friday, the 13th of July, year of our Lord, 2018. Hope everybody's having a good morning. Not a whole lot going on in the news today. Pretty slow news day, which is a good thing, I think. Anyway, our guest for today is Mr. Tom Berryhill, who I got a feeling will be on the line here momentarily, if he's not already. Okay. Anyway, he'll be on here in a minute, and we're going to talk about emergency ham radio communications. Now, folks, a little bit of history, and I'm sure Tom is listening right now, getting ready to call in. Originally, during the eras of duck and cover, you know, some of us remember the old black and white cartoons they used to show in school of the turtle and the firecracker and all that stuff. During that era, the federal government decided, since there were so many ham operators out there, why not put them to use? Well, I forgot the names of the various programs, but it all fell under civil defense. Well, anyway, Tom has been in ham radios for over 50 years. You know, I know a little bit about them. You know, I can operate them. I'm not licensed or anything like that. But to me, it's a very interesting subject. And one of the most fascinating parts of it to me, the equipment has been so miniaturized. Good morning, Tom. Did I just hear you? Come on, buddy. Maybe not. All right, we're getting him on right now.
I'm here, Tim.
Okay, good, good. Good morning, Tom. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. I guess there were some technical difficulties. I heard everything, so I'm here ready to go.
Oh, I'm glad. Okay, point out where I was wrong. No, in case I misled people accidentally. I was just going from memory.
Well, I did, fumbling around with switches and trying to get connected, I heard everything except the last few seconds. Dan came on for a minute to get me connected in, but You were talking about civil defense. You may have made a comment after that. That's the one I didn't hear. But
no, all I'm saying after that was the fact that I can't believe how miniaturized everything has become. You know, I remember my father's friends with their old ham radios and, you know, wires strung from the house to the barn and around the barn and back to the house and, you know, all, and those big tube sets, you know, you flip them on and it takes 5 minutes for them to warm up, you know, and all that. That, you know, that's the ham radio stuff I remember. And now it's all in a little tiny box.
Well, yes, it's really miniaturized, Tim. You know, when I got into it, this was I really got interested in it in the early '60s. My my dad wanted to do that. He had one of his jobs. He was in the Coast Guard, and one of his jobs on the frigate that he was on was to help the radio operator and take messages to other parts of the ship, right, and so on. But he was very interested in that and wanted to do it. After the war was over, he just never could grasp the Morse code, even though they had to learn it.
Right.
As they went into the military, they did have to learn that, but I guess he forgot it and tried to revive it. Anyway, it was very difficult, and he was cleaning out some desk drawers once and found the books and handed them all to me and said, "Here, maybe you want these." And I looked, I was 9 years old, I got very interested in it, and I saw the pictures,
right,
in there, these guys with their homemade equipment, and it was really, you know, for a nine-year-old kid, it just really lit my fuse. So I thought, I want to be just like those guys, and I wanted to,
right,
get into that. So that's what I did, and I started studying. I really had no help because there was nobody around that knew anything about it. I was kind of on my own, and I fumbled around with it for several years, and I took my first test when I was 11 years old. You mentioned civil defense, and that's where I took the test at the first time, and I failed because I just couldn't get the code speed fast enough. And I only needed 5 words a minute at the time, and that was, let's see, that was around 1965. So I had these code records, practice records, and I'd play these records, and I'd even play them at a faster speed to see if I could get up to speed that way. And what I didn't realize is I was memorizing everything that was on that record. So if the code test consisted of what was on that record, I would have passed at a pretty good speed. But so to get past all that, for my 13th birthday, I received a gift, which was a shortwave radio kit. And my dad helped me. We worked in the basement every night after school, and when he was home from work, and we would solder some more parts in that thing and built it, and we got it finally fired it up for the first time. I remember it was on a Friday night, and it worked, and I was tuning in stations all over the world, shortwave and so on.
Oh, yeah.
It was quite an experience for a 13-year-old kid. So.
Definitely.
Tim. And I'll tell you what. I started tuning in then on the ham radio bands, and that's when I could hear the guys talking, but also I could hear them doing the Morse code, and that,
right,
brought my code speed up pretty fast. So that was March of 67, and then I took my test. Now, it was an interesting time because I took my test in the first week of June of 1967, and then I was glued to that radio. I mean, we used to go out and we'd go down to the creek and throw rocks in the water and catch crawdads and snakes and lizards, always outside,
right,
goofing around. Well, now I was living in the basement with that radio, and I couldn't be bothered with other kid stuff. You know, I was in the big leagues at that point. So, and in the first week of June of 67, I'm tuning around, and this may interest a lot of the listeners. I heard these ham operators talking about one of our ships being attacked, and that was a USS Liberty. These guys had actually,
right,
picked up the distress calls, because I know at one point that, you know, I was probably hearing this after the fact because of the time difference and everything, basically in the other side of the world, you know, so
Right.
But these guys, and I didn't hear the distress calls directly, and that receiver I had wasn't the best. It probably wouldn't have picked it up anyway. But I could hear these other guys all over the states here talking about it, and I got all worked up, and I thought, well, maybe we're under attack or something. So I got in big trouble for this, but I called my dad at work and took him out of a meeting, and he was very upset, and he said, don't call me at work unless it's an emergency. And I said, Dad, this is an emergency. Israel's attacking one of our ships. He said, that could never happen. They're an ally. And, boy, he slammed that phone down, and I got grounded over that, Tim. And then that night, him and my mom were in the kitchen. I overheard them talking, and my dad made a comment. He says, I think we made a huge mistake getting that kid that radio. And anyway, it escalated from there. So that was my first taste of cover-up. You know, I knew that got covered up. The FCC had some delays processing their paperwork that summer. There was some kind of a computer glitch or something. My ham license didn't arrive until August of 67, and then I was able to get on the air, and I got a better receiver, and then set up my transmitter. And, of course, then school started, and I remember going to school and telling some of the other kids about what I'd heard, and nobody believed it, and even talked to the history teacher and told him, and he told me that I was wrong and that could never happen, and so on.
Uh-huh.
And of course all the listeners,
and you were vindicated many years later, of course.
Well, it took a while, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm telling this story because I think anybody that's interested in ham radio or shortwave receivers or things in general like that are keeping up with the news should really consider having a shortwave radio, because you're going to hear things like this. You can listen to the ham operators, and they have their own networks. They talk about a variety of subjects, but you never know what you're going to hear. And, of course, Tim, if there's anything going on somewhere in the world, many of these guys have tuned in and heard about it, and that combined their radio equipment and listening posts and all that combined with online internet discussions and so on, they get the word out pretty darn fast. And
Yes, they do.
And of course, back in those days that I'm talking about here was in the late 1960s. There was no internet or anything like that.
No.
So it was shortwave. And, you know, another funny thing, one of the first shortwave stations I picked up was Radio Havana, Cuba. And
Yes.
It wasn't too hard to hear them. I think that was a million-watt transmitter, and, of course, you know, just 90 miles from Florida. So that's one of the first stations everybody picks up. I think it was right at 6 megahertz, something like that, on the shortwave band. So, of course, that was English language broadcast, and being 13 years old, I had no clue about all the issues with that. I just knew that they said I could send them a postcard, and they would send me various mail from time to time. So I started getting all kinds of stuff from Cuba, and there were really some raised eyebrows around the neighborhood. Word got out, and the mailman was kind of asking questions, and nothing ever became of it. But I would get Christmas cards, and Tim, I think I still have those cards filed away somewhere. You would get a kick out of them. One of them, I'll never forget the one that was a Thanksgiving Day card, and it came from Radio Havana, Cuba. And the way the card, it was the way it was folded, it was like a turkey. And when you opened it up, the turkey's tail was Castro's beard. It was quite unique the way they made that card. And then they had all kinds of propaganda, and they'd send me newspapers and all that. So I've probably been under surveillance ever since, but, you know, I guess we all have in one way or another. So what? But anyway, that was my early days. And, of course, now what we did later... I got real interested in that was shortwave equipment and Morse code.
Right.
And I had microphones too, but I was so used to doing the Morse code that even to this day I prefer communicating that way, because it's actually, it gets through under all conditions. Even if there's a lot of static and noise, you can still get through. And it's a preferred way for emergency communications. Although single sideband is the king on ham radio, because that's where you use your microphone, and on shortwave bands you can talk all over the world. And many times,
right.
When the conditions are good enough, I mean, it's just like you're sitting in the same room with the person you're talking to, and they could be hundreds or thousands or 10,000 miles away, and it's that clear. It's amazing. And it's still a lot of fun to this day. I don't operate on there as much as I used to. I listen quite a bit. I like listening to some of those guys on there.
Right.
But anyway, but then I got interested in the mid-1970s. One of the things the guys were doing is they were setting up VHF 2-meter and 450 megahertz, but mostly 2-meter systems, and they had what was called
right.
simplex frequencies, and they would share information about foreign stations, which are called DX. So if somebody heard maybe a station in Africa or something, and everybody wanted to talk to them, they put the word out on that local network that covered, I was in St. Louis area at the time, and it would cover that general region, and they put that word out, and everybody could then get on their big ham set and try to work that station, probably in 20 meters or something like that. And
right.
so I would listen to those guys, and I got interested in, and we were using converted radios that came from older stuff that had been surplused out. And when new equipment was installed in police cars, taxi cabs, fire trucks, all that
right.
stuff was tube. Yeah, it was old stuff, Tim, tube type. And we could re-channel those things into the ham radio bands and set up our own networks with those. And I got very interested in that. And then I built some repeater systems. I built several of them in the mid-1970s with probably the biggest one was some General Electric equipment that we put on top of a tall building in Clayton, Missouri. It was I think the building was about 15 stories, and we had the antenna mast on top of that. And that gave us,
right.
yeah, that gave us communications all over the St. Louis region. I mean, it was on 449 megahertz in that era, in that band. So it was a UHF system, and
right.
it had had actually tremendous coverage for what it was. I remember at one point, a guy I knew that worked on radios for a police department said, you know, he says that system you've set up there is actually better in many ways than what the police are using. And we had it interconnected to a telephone line, so you could call that phone number, and the Motorola HT or walkie-talkie I carried in my pocket would start beeping, and we could answer the phone. Or you
right.
could push a star button on the little touch tone, the little dial pad on the walkie-talkie, you push that star button for 2 seconds, and that would get you a dial tone, and you could call anybody you wanted on that system. It was.
Well, I remember that system, actually, not the particular one, but I remember being able to do that with a little HT that had the keypad on the front, yeah.
Well, there were
anybody.
Yeah, there were many commercial systems set up with that type of equipment as well. And I'm just giving a rundown over the years of the things I've done. And then I was working with a couple of friends of mine, and we worked together on these things and built them. And I did most of the work myself in a little one-bedroom apartment. And then I'd have to get a two-wheel cart and wheel that cabinet out of there, and we'd take it up to put it on the building and set up the antennas. It was an education that I don't think you could get anywhere else. It was hands-on.
Well, I tend to agree with you.
Oh, yeah, and it was, we had a lot of fun with it, too. I got to tell you something, Tim. I went to a Radio Shack store. Now, that when you pushed a button if you transmitted with the microphone in the car or pushed a button on that walkie-talkie, that would transmit and key up that repeater, and it would identify itself with a Morse code.
I remember that too.
And so what happened one time, I went into a Radio Shack store. I needed a part or some batteries or something, and I had that walkie-talkie in my pocket, and I had the volume turned down. That was a good thing, because when I walked in, I started hearing that call sign coming out off of one of their scanners. So I started talking to the guy there at the counter, and he... I asked him, I said, what's that? I just played dumb, and I said, what's that coming out? What's that Morse code stuff? He says, oh, He said, that's a ham radio system. And he says, we have that channel on all the time. He says, you ought to hear those guys on there. He said, it gets really good at night. Because we'd go to nightclubs and bars. We'd call up the bar and order drinks and have them send them over to our table. And it was a fun thing. And these guys, right. I didn't realize these guys were all listening on scanners to all this. And we had to really tone it down. But we did have a blast with that. And back in those days, Tim, you know, now you pull something like that today and everybody just laugh at you because it's a joke next to these smartphones and all that. But this was 45 right. years ago, you know. And
well, you know, even 15 years ago there in Salem, Tom, you know, we had at home quite an elaborate setup on 462.7 and 725. And, you know,
yeah, that's a GMRS channel.
Right. That was when GMRS first came out. And, you know, people were jealous. We could all talk to each other without the use of a cell phone. Cell phones weren't even really out. And they were absolutely unaffordable. And there wasn't any service anyway. But, you know, the whole family could talk to each other from everywhere. And, of course, I had an 80-foot tower. And
that was a very good system for your area for emergency use. Now, with 80 feet, I don't know your elevation and all. How far would that go?
1,189.
Okay. So, now, Tim, when you had that set up at 80 feet, so I know a lot of the listeners would be interested in this, and you were using maybe mobile units and HTs. How far could you talk? How well did that work for you?
In miles, I'm not sure. And it also made a direction, a difference in what direction you went. I know one way it was only a mile. The other way, we could talk to Rolla, though, just as clear as if it was a telephone.
Oh, you could get all the way to Rolla?
Yeah.
That's a pretty good distance. How far is that, 30 miles?
At least 30 miles, yeah. But, you know, going south, or actually south, west, we could only go a mile or two.
That can happen. And when you get into the hills, that's why here in these rural areas they usually use VHF. They won't use UHF as much unless there's no frequencies available, and they may or sometimes in the, if they say it's a small town and they just have their utilities like the electric department or, you know, public works
right.
or something, they'll use UHF and they'll set up a small repeater just to cover their general area, and that works quite well. But
The reason we went with it with UHF is because I got a bunch of radios free, Tom.
Yeah, and also that was the only way you'd be able to set up a repeater. It's probably easier now, but it was rather difficult to get a repeater license on VHF frequencies back in those days. You had to really demonstrate a need for it, and it was a little bit more
right.
paperwork. But the GMRS was very easy to set up. You just filled out the license form, sent it in. I don't remember if it was a payment.
$75.
Was it? Okay, I didn't know about the fees on that.
$75 bucks for 5 years. Mine used
there you
to
go.
Be, we don't have it anymore. It was WPXX899 was us.
Yeah, there you go. And you wouldn't even have to worry about the call sign if you put one of those Morse code identifiers on it. It would do that for you automatic, and you would always be in
which I never did.
Well, yeah, there was things were kind of loose, and out here in the country, I mean, couldn't get in too much trouble.
No, we did
it
right, you know, in the transmission, you know, we always, you know, in the transmission call letters, you know, we did it right properly.
Yeah, yeah. I'm impressed that you were able to get from Salem area all the way up to Rolla. That's a pretty good haul. Was that with HTs or mobile units?
No, those were mobile units. We had some of those. You know, remember those big GE units that used to go in the trunk that were like 110 watts? You know, the sheriff's cars and all. Well, we put them behind the seats on pickup trucks.
Yeah, that's where they usually put them, and that was probably a relatively thin and long case. It was probably a Master 2.
And it weighed about 50 pounds, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that was probably...
I still got one of them.
Yeah, if you told me the model number, I'd tell you exactly what it was. But if it was a thinner case, it'd be a Master 2. And I'll tell you what, Tim, that's one of the finest two-way radios ever made. And that was what our repeater...
I bought that one for $5, and the crystals were $14.
Yeah, no, nobody wants that stuff anymore. I still have a couple of those Master 2s, and I have some Motorola Maritrax. They were a very high-quality radio, high power, 100 watts. And a lot of that equipment is still viable for ham use, and a lot of ham operators have put those, they've put those into use because although it's getting harder to get the crystals, you can't get them. One of the companies where everybody was going to get their crystals was International Crystal Company in Oklahoma City, and they've since shut down. They closed it down. I guess there wasn't enough call for it, and I don't know what everybody's doing now. Most of the radios nowadays are synthesized. You just program into the channel you want, and you're there. So, so the
if
GMRS...
If we ever do it again, you know, that's what we'll do if we ever do it again.
Yes, and the GMRS radios are a very good way to go for local communications. If somebody wants to just have a general setup for their area, that'll be on UHF, like you said, 462. I think it goes from about 462, 5.55 up to 462, 7.750, something like that.
Yeah, I think that's it. I know we had two channels we operated on, only because those were the easiest crystals to get. We were on 462.7 and 462.725. Those were the ones we use.
There you go. And was that set up as a repeater or just a base station?
No, just simple. No repeater.
Okay. See, had you set that up as a repeater, you could have easily interfaced that to the telephone without any operator intervention or anything. You just pushed a button on that thing and get the dial tone, and people could have called you. And that works pretty good in a rural area where there's not a lot of activity on those frequencies. In a metropolitan area, it would be a whole different story.
I took and I got a tone encoder, a brand new PE1000 tone encoder, and I paid nothing for it, like $6, brand new in the box. Well, I took it to a radio shop and had that hooked up, and then I found a whole box of UHF pagers. And I found a whole carton of crystals. And then all I had to do was get the right tones, the crystals for the right tones, and which was easy back then. And everybody in the family had a pager. It was a completely free service.
Walk
up the tone encoder and punch in 351 or whatever and hit send, and then you could do a voice message right after. And, you know, that way people weren't, you know, in the family weren't have to listen to, you know, static on a handheld all day.
Yeah, that
and
is
we also
really
had a couple of handhelds that, you know, would also, you could also tone the handhelds.
Yeah, that's true. And that was a really sophisticated system that you set up there for your own use. And again, in
and
a rural area.
It costs nothing, Tom.
Yeah, it's low cost, I know. And were you using, like, the small Motorola Page Boys or something like that?
Exactly what it was. They had the two crystals in it for the first set of tones and the second set of tones. And, of course, the pagers themselves were already set to frequency.
Yeah, well, those were called tone elements, and they would respond to a specific audio tone. And you would... And they had combinations, and some of them were more sophisticated, and they had five tones. But I'm thinking of I had one of those pagers that I used for my business in the 70s and 80s, and it was a Page Boy 2. It was a very small, slim, you just stick that in your pocket, you didn't even know it was there. And that thing would go off, it would beep, and then it would give you a voice message. And it was a very, very handy thing. I don't even know if they use them anymore. Everything is on a cell phone
I don't
nowadays.
Think so.
Yeah.
I don't think there are any use for them. I found a box of them that I didn't use in the garage the other day. Hey, here's our break, Tom. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back in 3 minutes. Call-in number is 800-313-9443. Back in three.
Yeah. You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong part, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll-free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Ladies and gentlemen, J.R. Moore here. We're continuing our Energy Cleaner promotion, which began August of 2016. In this promotion, you get to buy an Energy Cleaner, $70 off retail, and a mattress pad, 10% off retail. $200 of the purchase price of the Energy Cleaner goes to Republic Broadcasting. This is a great way to help get Energy Cleaners out to people who need them and have some financial issues to deal with. And, of course, a great way to support Republic Broadcasting. Here's what you do. Send in a postcard. My address is John Moore, P.O. Box 201, Davidsville, Missouri. We pick a postcard every 2 weeks. If your postcard is drawn, you get the chance to buy the Energy Cleaner $70 off retail and 10% off the mattress pads. Put your name and your address, your telephone number and your email address on the postcard, and we wish you the best of luck. Thank you.
Extendivite, a seven-herb combination of garlic, cayenne, hawthorn, bilberry, ginkgo biloba, valerian, and milk thistle. Extendivite is designed to strengthen the heart and arteries and help the body heal itself. Doctors are not able to explain the improvements they are seeing in their patients' health who are taking Extendivite. People who once needed more pills are now taking less and getting better. Due to the unexplainable improvements in their patients' health, more doctors are calling to order Extendivite for themselves. Help Extendivite make your doctor a believer. Extendivite is available in capsule or liquid form for just $69.95 for a 2 month supply. To get started, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Tim Spencer sitting in for John Moore on Friday, the 13th day of July, year of our Lord, 2018. Tom, we've got a caller on the line. We've got Kyle from Montana. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning.
What would you like to talk about today, sir? Yes, you're on the air.
Yeah, I had a question for your guest here. I've got a 2-meter license, but I was curious about something. I've heard it forever, and I've never really totally understood it. Could you explain single sideband for me? And maybe a lot of people don't know what single sideband is.
Well, I'll do the best I can, Kyle. It'd be easier if I had a chalkboard and a room full of people. I could draw some pictures, and they would instantly understand. But here's how it works. When you turn a transmitter, and let's start with Morse code. When you push a telegraph key down, it makes an RF frequency, a radio frequency. It puts out what's called a carrier. It's just a straight frequency. There's no modulation. There's no intelligence connected to that. It's just there. And in theory, if there's no modulation, it occupies zero bandwidth. It takes up no room. It's just a carrier. Now, what they would do is, well, how would I explain it? In the early days, we had amplitude modulation. You could take that carrier, and you could superimpose on it the audio signal, the voice information coming from the microphone, and that would vary the level, the output level, or the signal level of that carrier, so it would make it go up and down in amplitude that the receiver at the receiving end would pick up and decode and put out through the speaker. Well, the AM had an upper sideband and a lower sideband. So if you have this carrier on a specific frequency, when you talk, that modulation increases the bandwidth maybe up to 3 kilohertz or so in a communications channel on each side. On a high-fidelity AM broadcast, like in the broadcast band, it would be even wider than that. So that took up a lot of space, a lot of frequency space, and you couldn't have a lot of signals in a given spectrum, frequency spectrum that was allocated for that service with a whole lot of those signals. They would be walking all over each other, and also you would have heterodyne issues where signals were the carrier frequencies were close to each other, and they would form other tones as the two interfered with each other to make a tone called a heterodyne, and that would be if they were 500 cycles apart, you'd hear a 500 cycle tone, and that was called the beat frequency where the two carriers interacted along with the modulation. So it was just a bad situation all around. In the I believe it was in the 1940s, late 40s, they started experimenting with single sideband, and how it actually works is the carrier wave is actually suppressed, and the technical term for it is single sideband suppressed carrier. And what they do is they strip out the carrier itself or attenuate it greatly. It's almost not even there. It is a little bit, but not much. And then the voice peaks alone are the amplitude. So the voice information is there, but the carrier is suppressed, and then they filter out one of the sidebands. They'll leave the upper sideband, which is the because the information is identical on each side of that carrier frequency. You have a sideband going out positive in frequency, and on the lower side it's going negative in frequency. So if you have a 6 kilohertz channel width there, you'll have the same information on each side of that carrier. It's just not needed. It's not necessary to have the same information on each side. You can filter one of them out, and that's what they do, and that's how all the ham radio equipment works today. They'll use just one of the sidebands because the information is the same on each side of that carrier frequency. So you filter out the one, and that's done by some rather sophisticated electronic circuitry. In the early units, they used what was called phasing, and then they had what's called a balanced modulator, and you could adjust and null out the carrier and then just leave the intelligible information, which was the voice signal, and with the phasing network, you could actually notch out or eliminate one of the sidebands and leave the other one intact. You could select which one you wanted. On the lower ham bands, they use lower sideband. On the upper frequencies, they use upper sideband. The military and commercial traffic on shortwave and military communications, all of that, they use strictly upper sideband. Some of the radios won't even put out a lower sideband signal. Some will, but most of them will not, and they only use upper sideband. There's no particular reason for that other than that's what they chose when they set up those protocols for those systems. And the ham operators use both. Now, there's also ways to use what's called double sideband, where you have the carrier is gone, but the information is there, and you're using both sidebands. Just getting that carrier wave out of the way prevents all these heterodynes and squeals and interference and all that, and you only hear the voice signal. It is a little bit more difficult to tune in, and the reason it is because on the receiving end, if you don't have what's called a product detector or a BFO, which is beep frequency oscillator. You have to reinsert the carrier that's been taken away. So on the transmitting end, you got rid of that carrier, which is an energy hog. It takes a tremendous amount of power just to generate that carrier. And now you've stripped that out of the way, cut down on the power requirements of that transmitter dramatically, because you're only transmitting the voice peaks. If you're not talking, it's not really putting out any power at all. On voice peaks, the maximum power of the transmitter is being applied to the antenna. So at the receiving end, since that carrier wasn't there, the receiver can't make any intelligible signals out of that to the speaker. So what you do is you reinsert that carrier, and that's the function of the beep frequency oscillator, or in modern equipment, it's actually called the product detector. But it functions pretty much the same way. There's some technical differences, but we don't need to get into that. It basically reinserts that carrier, so now the receiver is picking it up as just the amplitude modulated signal, and it decodes that. You have to tune it in exactly, or it starts sounding like Donald Duck if you're not exactly on the right frequency. But with these modern radios, the frequency response and the just the quality of the circuitry is so good that if you tune that signal in exactly, it'll sound about as natural as being in the same room with the person you're talking to. And by the way, everybody might be interested in knowing that many of the telephone, the long-distance telephone circuits and all of that, and I remember a lot of the underground transmission lines, microwave systems, and I think that the cables that were laid in the ocean for connecting the continents together, a lot of that traffic was also turned into an RF carrier, and then they used single sideband that the AT&T would use on their long lines circuits. Now I'm no expert on that. I never worked on any of it. But I know from reading up on it that they did use single sideband, very low power single sideband circuits in there, and they could multiplex all that and put numerous talk channels onto one cable, and that's how they did that. So
I was just going to say, the reason I know that for a fact is because during the Cold War, both the Soviets and us would monitor those cables, and all we did was put a receiver, physically set a receiver on top of that cables with a recording device. I think it was one of the first digital recording devices. And all that traffic going across those cables were recorded. And there was
no physical contact.
It was just putting the antenna receiver, whatever you want to call it, right there on top or right beside those undersea cables.
Yeah, they would have a wide frequency spectrum that would go through those cables. Now, it was attenuated. They probably had to have repeaters along the way, and they could regenerate it and transmit it again for many miles or hundreds of miles and so on. But that's how they worked, and it was basically a radio system with single sideband. And maybe I'm going into a lot of detail here, but I'm trying to answer your question and paint a picture as to how this thing works. With a chalkboard, I could do all of this in about 1 minute.
Okay,
does that answer your question, Kyle? Did it make any sense?
To be honest with you, a little. But do you have a way of, can you put it in like one sentence? Like if you were boiling it all down, what is it then exactly? I mean, just in one sentence, can you do that?
It's an extremely efficient way of making use of transmitter power. I can explain it like this. Let's just say you want to mail a letter to somebody, and the post office uses a gigantic truck to carry that one letter across the state to its destination, when you could have just put that letter in a small truck and taken it and done the same job, but instead they're using this gigantic vehicle to haul that letter, and just a waste of energy and resources. And that's exactly what single sideband does. It cuts down on the transmitter power. It's extremely efficient, and most important, it really increases what's called the signal to noise ratio. So when you have very weak signals, many times a single sideband will get through, whereas an AM signal would be lost in the noise. So it, with real weak signal work, single sideband surpasses all of it. I believe the that's what they used on the now, a lot of people say we never went to the moon. I don't know. I'm on the fence about all of it, but much of that communications was on single sideband.
So, you know, I have a suggestion, and it would probably take two or three shows, I'm guessing. I have a suggestion that if you decided to do it, to spend a couple of shows on just the definitions of what these things are, and give you time to think them through and then say, okay, this is the basics of shortwave, so this is what this is, and this is what this is. And I mean, because you use these terms like it's, you know, drinking water, you know, VFO and you know, all of the single sideband and all of these different things. And I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that would be interested but that are sort of lost, you know, when it comes to this stuff.
Well, I'd be glad to do that, Kyle. And here's one way to do it. It'd be difficult for me to think it all because I might cover the wrong subjects. But if you or Tim or even John, if you guys wrote up an outline or just put the keywords in there, and I would do my best to come up with some simple explanations that could be described verbally, and we could certainly do that. And it would probably bore a lot of people, but maybe some of the newer ham operators would find it interesting, and maybe a lot of people that are interested in shortwave reception and things like that, they might find it of interest too. But I'd be glad to do that.
Yeah, excellent. All right, well, thank you. I have to run, but thanks for the show today, and thanks for sitting in for John, Tim.
Oh, yes, sir. I enjoy it.
All right.
Well, thank you for your call. I do appreciate it. Okay. We're coming up on a break, Tom, but we got about 4 minutes. Go ahead.
Okay. Now, see, Kyle asked a very important question. And again, it's so difficult to explain these technical issues without a chalkboard. I've given several presentations to John's group there in Viburnum, and I always had a whiteboard or a chalkboard, and we could draw pictures, and I did my best to explain things that way, how antennas work and gain antennas versus, just the whip antenna and so on, and I could show the differences in the radiation patterns and all that. And drawing pictures makes it so easy, but this way it's a little bit more complex. Some of the ham operators probably followed along with that just fine, and maybe some of them could have even done a better job. But, you know, the problem here, Tim, is that the equipment has become so reliable that and plug and play that the FCC has relaxed the requirements dramatically compared to past years and decades, and that you don't need to be an electrical engineer or anything to get into ham radio. I mean, I'm not any of that, and I learned it as I went along, though, and it's been the only electronic education I've had. I've never taken a formal course in any of it, and it's all hands-on and learning and sometimes some very expensive mistakes in the process, but that's how I've done it over the years. And you just kind of pick up on it and learn as you go and at a comfortable pace, and it worked out good for me. But the requirements have been so relaxed that just studying for 3 or 4 weeks, I really think almost anybody could pass that test. And then you can get on these radios, and like Kyle said, he's got a license, but he's not really familiar with the like single sideband and some of these terms.
Right.
And that makes a lot of sense because they don't go into it that deep to get the initial license. And the idea is that you can get on there, and now you've gotten involved and you're meeting people and talking to people on the radio, and the idea is that you can learn from that experience and learn from others and help each other, and so much of that goes on with the ham radio clubs, and these guys will all help you come up to speed. So it's what you want to do is not worry about all these technical issues. Just get in at the ground level, and you can work your way up from there. And I've always explained it as an apprenticeship, and you'll learn from the others. And there's all levels of expertise on that ham radio, from just physicists that can tell you everything about radio frequency, energy, and so on, all the way down to somebody that just has a sales job at a store, or they work for a plumbing company, but they're still interested. These people are still interested in communications, and so many of them have found that with the preparedness issues that it's really a requirement to at least have some basic understanding of how some of this equipment works and put these systems together. Now, Tim, you put together what I would consider a rather sophisticated system there in Salem, Missouri. That, like you said, you don't use it anymore, but I hope you still have that equipment and could put it back to. Yeah, don't let that get away from you, because that equipment could come in very handy sometime in the future. We never know what tomorrow's going to bring. So it's good to have
absolutely.
This equipment.
Yeah, I've got every bit of it except the pagers.
Well, these HTs are so small now, and you can actually set these walkie-talkies, or HTs as they're called, which stands for handy talkie. Yep. And by the way, that's a Motorola trade name, and that's how that came about. And they called all their portable radios handy talkies. And it's been copied, and it's just a generic term now, but that is a Motorola name. Some of these are so tiny that you can, and they'll have tone decoders and all that already built in.
Yes.
So all you need to do
all
is just
do
get
is
a few.
Plug them in the PC and program them.
That's it. And you could easily set that system up and still have quite a sophisticated communication system for your area. This can be done almost anywhere. And it's easy to get going.
All right, buddy. Well, we got our break, ladies and gentlemen. Final break of this hour. We'll be back in 3 minutes. And I believe next hour we're going to be talking to Dr. Phil Myers.
There is an ongoing war right here in America. Are you aware that U.S. citizens have been classified as enemies of the state since 1933? Have you recognized that our entire government is really a vast network of interlocking corporations engaged in commerce? Look up Title 28, Section 3002. Tune in to In Defense of Humanity on Saturday nights at 7 p.m. Central Time. Find out what's really going on and learn how to protect yourself and your family as flesh and blood men and women living in a corporate reality.
Tired of being lied to by mass media? It's growing more and more apparent today that news is received less and less through standard media outlets. Even with a growing audience every day, RBN is beginning to direct more efforts into social media. Social media and the use of the internet is fast becoming the primary source of people for news, regardless of demographic. RBN has set out to provide some of the best news on the internet through republicbroadcasting.org, and also has begun to use the tools to our advantage by way of social media. Republic Broadcasting is now operating a Facebook page to function as yet another avenue to have our collective voice reach new audiences across not only America, but across the globe as well. The Facebook page features not only news, but also an RBN player to listen to our broadcast. Get involved by visiting facebook.com/republicbroadcasting and liking our page, and share it with your friends and family, because you can handle the truth.
Hey folks, CBD is the home run hitter for health right now. Why, you ask? Because of what it does for the body. Unfortunately, I can't tell you all about the benefit. You know, there's reasons. Do your due diligence and log on to ancientlifeoil.com. That's ancientlifeoil.com. Ancient Life Oil uses organic ingredients and is blended in coconut oil. for some of the best benefits. Legal in 50 states and non-psychoactive. Log on to AncientLifeOil.com. That's AncientLifeOil.com.
Do you worry a lot? Whether you're a college student, busy professional, parent, or grandparent, ongoing stress and elevated levels of the stress hormone cortisol can rob your memory, your health, and your future. Now you can combat the effects of stress and anxiety while improving your memory and recall at the same time with the dietary supplement Calm and Clever. Studies show that the ingredients in Calm and Clever reduce cortisol by as much as 30% in 1 to 2 weeks. Call 1-800-758-8746 or calmandclever.com.
The 13th day of July, year of our Lord, 2018. Hope everybody's having a good morning. Right now, we're visiting with Mr. Tom Berryhill. We've come up against the end of the first hour. I know the theme of the show for today was supposed to be emergency communications, and I guess technically it was, but I was wondering if you could give a 2 or 3 minute little dissertation on why they're so important. I mean, you're preaching to the choir as far as telling me, but, you know, some people might be new listeners and might not quite understand the implications of no communications.
Well, Tim, communications is critical and vital in the event of an all-out emergency. I think it would be, at a minimum, I think everybody should have a shortwave radio and know how to use it. It can be entertaining. You can listen to the ham operators, and sometimes they're pretty colorful and entertaining.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm amazed that some of the stuff is allowed on there, but they can be quite entertaining. And you can read between the lines on that. But anyway, you'll hear a lot about what's going on. When there's an emergency, though, these guys shape up quick, and they will provide communications. They'll get information out. You can learn so much about what's going on, and that's on the short wave bands, which is right above the AM broadcast band. The lowest ham band there is 1.8 megahertz, and it goes up to right at almost the 30 megahertz. There's numerous ham radio bands in there. You'd be able to tune in. You'll hear a lot of military traffic on there. You'll hear foreign broadcasts. And Tim, you know that so many times the truth about what's going on in our own country will come from a foreign source. So one way to get that, and now, sure, you can listen to this on your computer and your smartphone and all that, but the powers that be can push the button, and that no longer works. But they can't stop that shortwave transmission coming in from other continents. So it's a good idea to at a minimum, have that shortwave receiver set up. Now, I know John sells some of those on his website. They're inexpensive and easy to get and relatively easy to use. You do have to develop a few skills with it, but it's not too difficult. There's more sophisticated models. You can spend thousands of dollars, or you can spend less than $100, and everything in between. So at a minimum, you want that. Then, of course, you want to set up, if you're going to become a ham operator, you can start with VHF and UHF equipment to talk in your local area and provide communications for yourself, your family, the neighborhood, and the local community. It would be very helpful, and that's the end of the show, so we can't go any further. We'll do some more next week.
Sounds great, Tom. Thank you for being on today. I personally appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back in 2.5 minutes. Dr. Phil Myers is scheduled to be on. We'll see if that happens. And just hang on.
My name is Don Wiskin, and at 42 years old, I suffered a massive heart attack, lost 35% of my heart to damaged tissue, and was supposed to spend the rest of my life on disability. What did I do? I took Extendivite, a garlic and cayenne mix of 7 herbs which rebuilt my heart and gave me back my life. For over 17 years now, I have made this formula available to you so you don't have to suffer the same thing I did. Clean your blocked arteries and strengthen your heart and boost your natural immune system. I'm 60 years old now, and I still work every day. To get your Extendivite, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit partdrop.com. Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply of either capsules or liquid.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.